This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
I am stunned! I am amazed!
Washington, D.C. experienced a rare moment of unity Wednesday night. The Nationals beat the Houston Astros in Game 7 of the World Series, giving the team its first Major League Baseball championship. But on Capitol Hill, the mood is decidedly less celebratory.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, the nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
It's not fair to the President of the United States. It's not fair to the House of Representatives, and it's not fair to the American people.
This morning, the House passed a resolution that sets up concrete rules around its impeachment inquiry in a vote that fell almost entirely along party lines. The vote comes days after Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman testified to Congress about his concerns that President Trump pressured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden. Vindman is the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, and he told House impeachment investigators that the White House memo of the July call between Trump and the Ukrainian president omitted key words and phrases. Trump's allies immediately started questioning Vindman's loyalties and patriotism because his family fled Ukraine when he was 3 years old, like many Jewish refugees living in the then Soviet Republic.
Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House, apparently against the president's interest, and usually they spoke in English.
He has an affinity, I think, for the Ukraine. He speaks Ukrainian. He came from the country, and he wants to make sure they're safe and free. I understand that.
That was Laura Ingraham on Fox News and former Representative Sean Duffy on CNN. But Vindman isn't the first military official to be attacked by President Trump or his supporters. Since taking office, the president has repeatedly lashed out against high-ranking military members and veterans who publicly disagree with him, including the late Senator John McCain. At the same time, current and former members of the military have become more vocal in their criticism of President Trump and his policy decisions, renewing a debate over if and when military officials should break their code of silence. Today, we'll take a look at morale in the military in the age of Trump. Joining me now are Missy Ryan, a reporter at The Washington Post covering the Pentagon, military issues, and national security, and William Arkin, an Army veteran, journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military. Missy, William, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
William, early in the Trump administration, and even when he was on the campaign trail, President Trump praised the military. He called them, quote, my generals. He stacked his cabinet with career military officials. Why was he so attracted to a strong military presence initially?
Well, I think that Donald Trump, in fact, started his candidacy for president being very critical of the generals. He actually said negative things about Colin Powell, and he said negative things about John McCain. He lambasted Obama's generals. In fact, as candidate, he got away with criticizing the American military in a way that I would think a normal candidate might not get away. Then when he became president, he obviously reached into the ranks of the military, retired military, James Mattis as Secretary of Defense, John Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Flynn as his National Security Advisor. But he soon grew weary of all of them, or they grew weary of him. Donald Trump doesn't have good relationships with anyone, and it seems to me that the military is no exception. I'm not sure I would actually argue that they are an exception. There's lots of reasons why the military and Donald Trump are at loggerheads, but I don't particularly think it means that the military is one thing or that there is bad morale within the military.
Let's dig into a little bit of that, Missy. To William's point, I mean, this isn't the first time we've seen President Trump lash out at or criticize military members. Again, we mentioned John McCain. I recall thinking at that moment that, and I said this on CNN, that that was a turning point in his campaign, and he since was elected. So why do you think the president, Missy, is so publicly alienated certain members of the military?
Well, I think it's really a hallmark of Trump's presidency to lash out at a whole array of individuals and members of the military, and high profile retired and serving officers just happen to be among them. I don't see him especially singling out members of the military for criticism, but what makes it unusual when he does is that you know, there has been a code in American political life to some extent, although there certainly are numerous exceptions, that current and even often former military officers try to refrain from getting involved in partisan politics. Again, there have been a lot of high profile exceptions to that. But what Donald Trump is doing is seeming to, like he does with so many other things, sort of shrug off those norms. And what you're seeing because of that, and because of the policy actions that he's taken, because of his style, because of his erratic policy pronouncements, you're seeing this tension within the ranks about whether or not military officers have a duty, an ability to speak out when they disagree with the president. And I think that that's the tension that you're seeing within the current and the sort of former high profile military ranks. But, you know, I think that at the end of the day, most officers will acknowledge that, you know, President Trump was the elected civilian leader and he's in the White House and he's the commander in chief. So as long as it's not an order that is unlawful, that members of the military have a duty to carry out his orders.
William, so building on that, you mentioned earlier, I started talking a little bit about morale. A lot of the officials that are speaking up are either retired or high profile. What's your sense of what morale is like on the ground? I'm thinking with the military action that just happened in Syria, and we still have troops in Afghanistan and beyond.
Well, it's important that the listeners understand that the military is not one thing. There's a Washington military, and then in many ways, there's the rest of the military. The people who serve in Washington and are, who are in the fishbowl of political life are very different than those who are out there in the field. And I think the military is fundamentally mission-focused. It's fundamentally process-oriented. And so the consistency to do the mission, to soldier on, to do it in a way that is following the rules and the operational plans, you know, that's not being really interrupted out there in the field. And in a funny way, in a week in which Special Operations Forces killed Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, it shows that despite all of the turbulence that Donald Trump introduces in his, are we in Syria, are we out of Syria, and all of the process things that he violates, the clandestine forces, the special operations forces, the intelligence forces continue to operate. And that was the same even during the Obama administration. So as far as I see it, in my 40 years, I look at the military and I say to myself, yes, there is a split between the warriors and the non-warriors, and there is a split between the Washington military and the non-Washington military. And there are many who express alarm about Donald Trump. But to tell you the truth, when Barack Obama became president and he was talking about closing Guantanamo and getting out of Afghanistan and getting out of Iraq, there were as many people who I heard who were saying that he was a menace to national security as I hear today about Donald Trump.
Missy, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, because the president has been quite unconventional, if you will, and has broken protocol in many instances. I'm thinking most recently his press conference on the killing of al-Baghdadi. You know, the press conference, when you compare that to the way President Obama announced the death of bin Laden, you know, in less than 10 minutes, I believe, versus a press conference that many would describe as rambling, full of fantasy. There's no proof of the whimpering of a dog detail, for example. Is the military cringing here when they see that the president is sort of breaking protocol by announcing things on Twitter, by having open-ended press conferences, by sort of not following the traditional rules?
Well, I do very much agree with William when he says that it's hard to make generalizations about an organization that has more than a million active duty members. And certainly there are things that Donald Trump has done for the military that are deeply appreciated, starting with restoring a larger budget for the military than it's had in a while. And, you know, that makes everybody happy in the Defense Department and the defense establishment. But there are definitely a number of things that I think cause grave concern. And I would start with, as you said, his style, his policy pronouncements that sometimes, you know, take 180 turns within days. There is concern that that creates an appearance of unreliability for America's partners. And then the second thing, and I think even larger and more far-reaching within the ranks, is the concern about what Trump's attitudes are towards the countries that are America's traditional defense allies. And this is when Trump questions the value of NATO, when he suggests that the United States might not abide by Article 5 of NATO, when he questions the need to keep forces in South Korea or Japan or Germany. And more recently, we saw this with the incident that you mentioned in Syria, when he abruptly announced that he was pulling U.S. forces from northern Syria. And the perception there, of course, was that the United States was abandoning Kurdish Syrian forces that had been fighting alongside the United States against the Islamic State. And so the idea that the United States, number one, is seen as a bad partner, and number two, actually might not be able to recruit partners, that the whole counterterrorism strategy, for example, is predicated on working with other countries and subnational groups. And so that those things are the things that I think are at the core of these concerns that we're seeing within the military.
Also, you mentioned recruitment, Missy. I mean, some of the critical recruits here are folks that are going to serve rank and file in the military. And William, you've written about the decline in those numbers. And of course, that's been happening for years, not just under this administration. But I wonder if you see some of the tensions that are playing out now between President Trump and military leaders, at least the high profile ones, the Washington military, as you call them, the sort of erratic behavior on pulling troops in and out and how he approaches foreign policy, whether or not that will have any effect on recruitment efforts overall?
Look, Donald Trump has been extremely disruptive in American society and, of course, within the institutions. And certainly one of the institutions that is both the most respected in polling and also the one that feels it is the flame keeper, if you will, with the traditions and the lineage is the U.S. military. The irony here, at a time when the military is getting an increased budget, at a time when the military is being given more leeway, where the rules of engagement in military operations are being loosened by Donald Trump, is that they can't make their recruitment goals. And we're not talking about something which is very big. The military needs about 100,000 18-year-olds every year in order to replenish its ranks. And out of some, I don't know, 20 million plus 18 to 24-year-olds in American society, it can't not even attract 100,000 people. And that's because of a lot of reasons. But the one that I think is most important is that America's youth is not behind the war on terrorism, is not behind the American military. And the American military as an institution is increasingly distanced from American society. And so when I think about Donald Trump, or I think about Barack Obama, or I think about the future, the real crisis is that the American public, the American society, is not with the American military. The American military is increasingly an institution out on its own.
William Arkin, Army veteran, author, and journalist, and Missy Ryan, reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks to you both for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.